It is really clear that ownership of the schools, some degree of self-determination is necessary. It's not sufficient. It's not enough, but it's how you get started.
Seeking big change for rural Alaska schools. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, May 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an eagle may have caused last month's fatal South Central plane crash.
After a forensic analysis of the substance, it was determined to be from a bald eagle.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Commercial, sport, subsistence, personal use. Some hear these labels and think conflict. The Salmon Project sees connections. Join 10,000 Alaskans whose lives are connected by Alaska salmon. Visit salmonlife.org to experience the stories. And find the Salmon Project on Facebook to join the community. Salmon Life, Salmon Love. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
It's been more than 2 weeks since the legislature was scheduled to finish its session. But not only have lawmakers not finished their work, there's been little progress recently, at least in public. There have been no public meetings on the contentious oil and gas tax bill, and no recent meetings on the state budget or changes to the permanent fund. APRN's Andrew Kitchenman has been following what's happening in Juneau. Andrew, hello.
Hi, Lori.
So why aren't Alaskans seeing more progress?
There are a few reasons. One is that the House has focused on the criminal justice overhaul bill this week. Members continued to debate amendments to the bill today, and there could be a vote on the bill as soon as tonight. This bill has had an unusually long floor debate. It would reduce some sentences, and that's put members in a difficult position since they don't want to be insensitive to crime victims. But many members also want to reduce the number of prisoners, as well as the need to build a new prison.
Okay, so what else is holding up action?
Well, the legislature's move from the Capitol late last week may be a minor factor, since legislators are getting used to their new home in the Bill Ray Center. But more importantly, there remain big differences over the oil and gas tax bill. Governor Bill Walker wants to dramatically cut the tax credits and increase the minimum tax that companies pay. The House Resources Committee had really scaled back the bill, and after the scheduled end to the session passed, the House Rules Committee came up with its own version of the bill, and that has some things that the Walker administration actually likes. They include eliminating tax credits for the Cook Inlet. But Walker has concerns with other pieces of the bill, like shifting more of the benefits of tax deductions to large producers and keeping Cook Inlet tax credits for another 3 years. While there's been no public talks, there have been private discussions about the bill. Those close to the talks say there's been some progress, but much ground still needs to be covered. Without this bill, work on other major bills isn't going to happen.
There is a lot of other work to do. Is there anything else happening?
Some minor things. The House Finance Committee has heard bills that would raise taxes on commercial fishing yesterday, and then today they heard a similar bill for mining. But not much else. There's only one committee meeting scheduled for tomorrow, and there's a good chance that that'll be canceled.
Andrew, when you talk to lawmakers, what do legislators say about getting things done without a special session stretching into June?
I'm hearing a lot of uncertainty, but I think most are resigned to holding a special session. The oil and gas tax bill still is a challenge, and there will be a lot of work to do when it's done. We may have a better sense in the next few days once work on the crime bill is done.
All right. Thanks for that update, Andrew.
You're welcome, Laurie.
That was APRN and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reporting from Juneau. A wide-ranging education bill emphasizing local and parental control has died after a vote in the State House today. House Bill 156 was introduced by Representative Wes Keller. The latest version would have suspended statewide standardized testing for 2 years, allowed parents to opt their kids out of any lesson, and put decisions about sexual education in the hands of local school boards. This version had already failed in the House. The conference committee took it up Tuesday and returned an identical version to the House floor, with the bill's sponsor, Representative Keller, expressing confidence that it would get enough votes. This afternoon, the House failed the measure by a vote of 20 to 19. It needed 21 yes votes to pass. The voting mostly fell along caucus lines, with a few exceptions. All four rural Democrats voted against the bill. Many of Alaska's rural schools are failing. Low student performance and high teacher turnover are just two of the more obvious indicators of problems in these mostly native school districts. APRN contributor Johanna Urick reports those working in the schools say it's time for radical changes.
Paul Berg has taught in Alaska for more than 40 years, 10 of them in villages.
You want to see racism, go to a village school. You'll see outside, usually Anglo teachers, have the best jobs, the most pay. Vast majority of administrators will be Anglo. It is not working. The statistics and the data are very clear.
Berg, now 70, teaches high school students during the summer and works as a cross-cultural specialist for the Gold Belt Heritage Foundation. He, among other educators meeting this month at the University of Alaska Native Studies Conference, described schools as colonial forces, not that much different from the boarding schools of years ago that punished Native students for speaking their languages.
Education is the means whereby a culture perpetuates itself and transfers itself to the young. Public education has taken this away from the Yupik, the Inupiaq, the Aleut, and others, and given basically middle-class America to these people. As to the degree that they wish that, that should be their choice, but they should have the inalienable, undeniable right to transfer the culture and the language to their children. It's called the right of cultural sovereignty. And English-speaking nations are among the last on earth to recognize it.
My prayer is that Tlingit is going to live forever, because we want our little babies to be talking.
Hene Lance Twitchell is using every means possible to make sure his children speak his native language. He speaks Tlingit to them instead of English, knowing that the media environment will make sure they learn English. He wants bilingual and Tlingit immersion schools. He sees the shortfall in state education funds as an opportunity, because it prompts many to ask the question, why keep spending lots of money on a system that doesn't work? Diane Hirschberg is the director of the University of Alaska Anchorage Center for Education Policy Research. She studied the indigenous education systems throughout the world to find out which were successful and why.
So we're talking from Maori students to Greenlandic students to Hawaiian to lower 48 American Indian. And it is really clear that ownership of the schools, some degree of self-determination, is necessary. It's not sufficient. It's not enough, but it's how you get started.
Hirschberg joins many Alaska Natives in advocating that the state help tribes access federal Indian education funds to support Native schools. They argue it's time to spend money on something that works.
I don't know to what extent the state is willing to say to tribes, well, okay, you can get this other funding. Legally, it's allowed. Maybe you should take this on. You know, it relieves the pressure. The state constitution says we must provide an education. But if those students are receiving the education from a voluntary tribal-run system that is paid from outside, you know, is the state willing to set up the conditions for that to happen?
Natives living in rural Alaska say they need successful schools teaching their children Native language and traditions. Raina Hartz, whose mother's family is Yupik, says failing to provide such an education is not an option.
The failure to educate a child in our area isn't just that the child doesn't get an education. For us, it very often becomes a civil rights issue and a human rights issue, because many of these children don't fit in and they don't belong and lead to suicide. this isn't an educational issue. This is the right of a child to have a vibrant and viable future.
Raina Hartz is acting superintendent at the UPeet School District. I'm Johanna Urich.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Sitka resident objects to taxes on her land that was ruined in a landslide.
Paying property taxes on a piece of property that you'll never live on and never use is difficult for her.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Investigators with the National Transportation Safety Board say a plane that crashed on April 20th, killing four people, hit a bald eagle before it crashed. Sean Williams, who is leading the investigation, says samples of an unknown substance found on the tail of the Cessna 172 were sent to Washington, D.C. for analysis.
Wreckage examination after it was retrieved from the accident site, a foreign substance was found on the tail, or the tail section of the airplane. So we took samples of that and sent it to the Smithsonian Institute back in Washington, D.C. for further analysis. After a forensic analysis of the substance, it was determined to be from a bald eagle.
The plane crashed in thick woods about 2 miles from the Birchwood Airport north of Anchorage. An early NTSB report on the accident indicated the plane hit a 100-tall-foot spruce tree and burst into flames on impact with the ground. The fire consumed much of the wreckage. Williams says the new information is not to be considered conclusive evidence that the bird strike was the cause of the crash.
The factual report will be released in 10 to 12 months with the probable cause about 30 to 60 days following that. Right now what we have is the material, the substance that was found on the aircraft. Now we're going to go back and try and figure out what cause or what effect that would have had on the accident sequence or the aircraft itself.
Pilot George Kobelnik and three others, Christian Bors, Sarah Glaves, and Kyle Braun, died in the crash. A preliminary report on the accident was released by NTSB on April 27th. A grass fire near Wasilla was reported by a pilot about 3 p.m. this afternoon. The fire has burned into the trees and is covering about 7 acres, according to State Fire Information Officer Norm McDonald.
Well, right now we've got a fairly good response through our cooperators with the Matsu Borough and then Division of Forestry as our helitac crew and air tanker, two engines, and also a hand crew en route. You know, if we get those folks on there and utilize the air resources, we're hoping to catch it before it gets significant spread.
McDonald says the fire is burning to the north and northwest near Schrock Road. Winds in the area are 5 to 10 miles an hour with stronger gusts. He says there are several buildings to the east of the fire, but no residences in the immediate vicinity. A 15-man crew is responding. Borough written statements say temporary flight restrictions are in place. Conditions in the Matsu are extremely dry. Last night, McDonald spoke to the Matanuska-Susitna Borough Assembly to inform the public about a new state permitting requirement for burn barrels. A Sitka property wiped out by last year's deadly landslide is still taxable, at least according to city code. The Sitka Assembly met Monday as the Board of Equalization to hear an appeal from the owner of a home on Kramer Avenue. The home was demolished in the August 18th landslide, killing three men working on the subdivision. KCAW's Emily Kwong has more.
Does land have value if a landslide went through it? Chris McGraw says no.
Paying property taxes on a piece of property that you'll never live on and never use is difficult for her.
The her in question is Christine McGraw. She bought the land, Lot 1, in the North Woodbury subdivision for $110,000 in 2014 to build a home. It was partially complete when the landslide hit, killing two construction workers painting inside and the city's building inspector. Christine was traveling during the appeal, so her ex-husband, Chris, represented her before the assembly, acting as the Board of Equalization.
She lost her house and it was not insured, and so there's significant financial loss on her part.
Now, here's the tricky part about this case. Sitka does not have anything in code about how to adjust value after a natural disaster, which left assessor Wendy Lawrence in a tough spot. She told the assembly that in previous Sitka landslides, property values were seldom adjusted and dropped 20 to 30% at most. The Kramer slide is clearly a unique case.
This was an unprecedented event. You know, we did not have loss of life in the prior slides, but I have to have a standard procedure on which to evaluate everyone.
Without a legal compass to follow, Lawrence took her cue from Juneau's mass wasting ordinance for landslides, which advises property values be reduced by 50%. The assembly approved, and when the January 1st assessment rolled around, Lot 1's new value was $52,700. The McGraws think it should be zero. Here's Chris.
If what we're going by is fair market value, and you're not going to be able to sell this property for possibly, you know, years to come, 10-20 then, and it has no value.
Saying that is one thing, but proving the land would flop on the market is a different story. In these appeals, the burden of proof is on the petitioner, not the assessor, and the McGraws didn't bring any factual or written evidence that the land could not be sold because they hadn't put the property up for sale. Four parcels in the vicinity have sold since the landslide. Basically, the argument Lot 1 would have no buyer for even building a storage shed needed more proof. Here's Mayor Mim McConnell.
If you had anything in writing of someone saying, I was interested and looked and said, no, I'm not going to buy this.
No.
That would be some evidence that we could accept. You're asking us just to take your word for it, but we need to have some evidence.
On those grounds, the land's value was upheld, which means Christine McGraw will have to pay $312.60 in property taxes. As the Board of Equalization, the Assembly is bound by pretty strict legal standards. But Assembly member Matthew Hunter lamented this is the way it has to be.
We're kind of stuck here by code and the process that we have created.
Hunter added that next year, when the board meets, he hopes Christine McGraw will have more evidence. Chris McGraw said the same.
My hope is for next year, now that they have the hazard assessment, that they may reevaluate those valuations for the parcels up there.
On January 1st, the city prohibited construction in the area until an engineer does a hazard assessment. And those findings may be the key to truly valuing the land for what it's worth. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by
ExxonMobil Alaska, working with more than 100 Alaska communities and thousands of Alaskans. Today, ExxonMobil is producing natural gas condensate from the Point Thompson facilities.
The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
AC Quick Stop opened Bethel's first liquor store in more than four decades yesterday. KYUK reporter Anna Rose MacArthur found a line of around 10 people waiting for the doors to open.
I want to be the first customer that walked into the liquor store in Bethel after 40 years.
Corey Stelmack is turning 40 this month, and today he could legally buy spirits in Bethel for the first time. But once the doors open, he has competition from Mike McIntyre to be the first customer.
I'm buying Alaskan Amber, trying to beat Corey here to be the first one.
Mike's at one cash register, Corey's at the other.
But we'll consider ourselves the first ones.
They pull out receipts to compare times.
Yeah, 1101. 1101.
We're both 1101.
And what was it that you bought?
I bought one bottle of Jameson, one bottle of Crown Royal, and two six-packs of Corona. And I'm going to go enjoy them right now.
Tony is right behind them, buying a box of wine.
T-O-N-I, and last name T-O-N-Y.
She's with her wife, Christine Nick.
Hi.
Hello. This is my wife.
It's
So are you going to join the wine together today?
Oh, she, no, she doesn't drink.
I am gladly to say I'm happily sober. I've always been sober. I've been sober more than 7 to 8 years.
So what do you think about, like, you're sober, but what do you think about a liquor store opening up in Bethel?
She was really mad.
I was mad at first, but I can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
I'm always there for her.
James Kelly came with the couple. He's Tony's cousin and is hopeful that the liquor store will be a good thing for the community.
It'll get your bootleggers to bootleg.
The store's already helped Jeremy Lee, one of the new security personnel. Lee had spent 7 months applying for jobs before getting hired.
I'm happy where I am, you know, because now I can feed my kids more and I can support my family. You know, I'm looking at it as a family man.
Lee says Bethel is in a new era. Those old times over 40 years ago, when things got so bad that Bethel banned alcohol sales, he calls those the immature years. But not everyone is so sure. Ignace Mathis bought a 6-pack of Alaskan Amber, but says he's torn about what legal sales mean for Bethel.
What's that like to be able to now, like, come in to a liquor store in Bethel?
Well, it's kind of really uncomfortable. It's going to be kind of hard for the community.
So you're kind of conflicted about it?
Yeah. Yes.
Bethel lifted its ban on alcohol sales 7 years ago. The public was also conflicted, citing fatigue with the stiff penalties of restricted sales, but not really embracing legal sales. A community vote in 2010 showed a majority of people oppose legal alcohol sales, but that trend reversed last year, when another vote showed a majority supported sales, but only for a package store like AC. The Quick Stop received its license a month later. The liquor store is a small white box, a former storage area. Wine, beer, and spirits line the few shelves behind the service counter. Walter Pickett, AC general manager, says the selection is a fifth of what it'll be in the fall, when the store completes its more than $1 million renovation and expansion. For now, he says, it's mostly bestsellers from their other stores.
Spirits, R&R is the bestseller. The bestseller on the beer is Budweiser by far. Coors Light is second there. And then our customers do like box wine because it's portable.
Pickett says the opening wasn't exactly the mad rush they were preparing for. Others in town are also bracing for possible impacts. Both the Bethel police and fire chiefs expect call volume will increase with the store's opening. Facebook comments predict inevitable death and abuse. But no one knows what's going to happen. One of the first customers, John McIntyre, who bought a 6-pack of Blue Moon and a bottle of rum, says whatever does happen will say a lot about Bethel.
I do think it's time we grew up. I mean, there's legal booze sales in Dillingham, McGrath, Nome, Kotzebue. If it doesn't work here, it's us, not the booze.
The store earned about $1,350 in the first hour and served more than 500 customers throughout the day. At the AC Quick Stop in Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Researchers are trying to determine whether strong winds blowing over the Valley of 10,000 Smokes on the Alaska Peninsula can transport dangerous amounts of ash into the Kodiak environment. To help them collect data, they'll turn to a pair of particulate monitors they set up last week, one on Coast Guard property and another in Larsen Bay. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche went with geologist Christy Wallace to visit the monitor located near the Kodiak base.
The particulate monitor, with its metal head and tripod legs, looks like a robotic scarecrow. Wallace opens the door to the main compartment, and inside is a pump, the source of the puttering sound.
It's preferentially sucking in particles that are fine-grained, so that can be respired into the human lung. So basically the size is about the thickness of a human hair, so really, really, really tiny. So it's preferentially sucking particles that fall out of the sky. It could be road dust, could be fire. In my case, I'm interested in volcanic ash, but it could be anything.
She says those particles end up on a length of tape, which researchers can examine using a microscope. She says the strip mostly takes in volcanic ash, which contains tiny glass shards. Not only can too much ash threaten air quality, but Wallace explains glass particles melt at jet operating temperatures and can shut down plane engines. But is that a problem in Kodiak? Wallace says in the windier and drier months of spring, summer, and sometimes fall, Kodiak still gets hit by ash left over from the Alaska Peninsula's 1912 Novarupta Katmai eruption, the 20th century's largest eruption.
The ash is picked up by these wind events and resuspended into a cloud that, for all intents and purposes, looks just like an eruption cloud. So looks like an ash cloud, although we know it's not from an eruption. And those clouds are then dispersed and carried over Shelikof Strait to Kodiak and into the Gulf of Alaska.
Wallace says they set up particulate monitors in Kodiak last fall. She says they collected data between September and November and recorded three small events. She says they plan to leave the particulate monitors up longer this time, and researchers are trying to determine how much glass is in the ash clouds, whether the ash is hurting air quality, and whether it poses a danger to aviation.
We also want to better understand, when we see a satellite image, what is that really telling us? Sometimes we look at them and say, oh, there's not much ash in the cloud. We don't get a good ash signature. And so, you know, maybe there's not going to be fallout in Kodiak. But we found out in the last, you know, the fall deployment, that when we saw a satellite image with a very small concentration of ash, it actually did fall out in Kodiak. And so it's helping us to better interpret the satellite imagery.
So far, Wallace says the ash does not appear to be hazardous to people on the ground. As for aircraft, she says the United States Geological Survey and the National Weather Service work together to pinpoint ash clouds and issue warnings
so that aviators can steer clear of those clouds when they're happening. And they do happen in Kodiak, you know, anywhere between 1 and 7 times a year, probably over the last 100 years. So it's a very common occurrence. But usually, you know, there's a low concentration of ash in these clouds, so it's not a significant hazard, we don't think, to the island, but certainly to aviation it is.
Wallace says they'll use the monitors this year to gather the full spectrum of data from spring through summer and into fall. In other words, they'll gather the beginning, the middle, and the end of Kodiak's ash fall story. I'm Kayla Deroche.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Hannah Colton in Dillingham, Johanna Urich and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Emily Kwong in Sitka, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Alaska Pacific University is still accepting applications for its Early Honors Program. The Alaska Pacific University Early Honors Program satisfies high school graduation requirements while students earn college credits from a regionally accredited institution. Early Honors students gain these benefits and make the best use of their senior year of high school. More at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.